But if you had time to study it, it would be helpful. And in retrospect, you can still look through these verses. Do people see angels today? And I'm going to hold off on answering that question until we get through, and then I think it'll be obvious, the answer. Any others who need the handout? It's a series of events recorded in the Bible, a dozen or so. Not the only ones, of course, just some selective ones that have to do with responsibility and leadership, a few things like that. Where angels appeared on the scene. And we want to look at some of the common elements of these events. I want you to notice particularly that we have in these events sort of generic occasions that we run into as well, even in today's life. Some sort of things that happen to everybody, more or less, sometime in your lifetime. And in the event, we will see what God thinks about it. What stirred him to send an angel to the scene to do something in behalf of the individual who is in difficulty or trouble or doesn't know what to do or in a conundrum of some sort. And so we learn God's will in these events. That's the thing I want you to focus on. What is it that God thinks is important? And what does he tell these people to do? Because when it happens to us, then we already know what God would recommend that we do, right? But on the other hand, we can be sure that if there's any doubt about the outcome of it, that God will indeed dispatch an angel to the event to help resolve it in some way or another. And so those are the things that we want to look for because they will guide us when we come to events like this in our lives. That's what we want to look for in today's lesson. And so the first few are fairly simple and straightforward. We'll use them as examples till we get to the more complicated ones. Now we have to be careful about current events because of this sort of a disclaimer in Hebrews and 2 Corinthians. Now, we talked about the one in Hebrews before. Do not forget to entertain strangers, for by doing so, some people have entertained angels without knowing it. And we talked about that particular occasion when Abraham met the three men who were traveling. They stopped by his tent, and he entertained them, didn't he? It doesn't mean that he showed them the latest TV program or anything. What he was doing was feeding them, of course, and helping them to rest on their travels to send them on their way. And in the process, he found out who they were. Surprise, surprise. But 2 Corinthians warns us that on occasions like this, not all people who we might look at and say, well, perhaps that was an angel, such men as false apostles, he's talking about a situation that he's encountered, particularly in Corinth, men who claim to be apostles, but they're deceitful workmen, masquerading as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It's not surprising then that his servants masquerade as servants of righteousness. Their end will be what their actions deserve. These are deceitful workmen. So you may encounter one of Satan's angels sometime in life too. How can you tell the difference? I think we already know basically how to distinguish the two. Suppose angels appear as men. I don't know that they ever appear as women. We don't have any occasions like that. But they appear as men, and maybe Satan's angels appear as men. And how would you distinguish the two. Now today I want you to talk to me some, because all of these situations we're going to look at, we need to discuss them. Even if they can perform miracles, yeah, and but they're deceitful, and so that's what Paul says here in 2 Corinthians. Their actions deserve the ending that they get, and so it's just like judging men. We do have to distinguish between servants of righteousness and servants of God and servants of Satan among the men and the people we know by their fruits. You shall know them. So don't jump to conclusions right away, but as you observe, you should be able to tell the difference. 1 Timothy 4:1 says, deceiving spirits, and that's kind of what Paul was talking about here, wasn't it? So you can tell by their actions, but just keep that in mind as we go through that. We're not going to talk about that anymore. We're going to talk about angels of God, of course. Okay, one other thing, Tyrone. 2 Thessalonians 2:9. That's right, that there will be people who seemingly perform miracles, but they're counterfeit. Okay, let's look at the first one. And I have them numbered, and so we can talk about number one or number six or whatever. And number one is a fairly simple one, having to do with Abraham's family. You know the background to this one. We've talked about it many times, in that Abraham and Sarah didn't have any children, and so Sarah gave him her handmaiden to bear a child in her name. And the handmaiden's name was Hagar. And sure enough, Hagar got pregnant, and then Sarah was jealous. And so there was some sort of a fight occurred, and Hagar ran away. Angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was the spring that's beside the road to Shur, and he said, Hagar, servant of Sarai. Sarah hadn't had her name changed yet, and Abram was really Abram at this point, not Abraham. Where have you been? Where have you come from, and where are you going? And her answer was, I'm running away from my mistress Sarai. Then the angel of the Lord told her, go back to your mistress and submit to her. Do you know of an occasion in the New Testament where that sort of a situation was answered in much the same way? The book of Philemon, I heard somebody say, and that's correct. Paul was advising Onesimus, a slave, to do what? Go back to Philemon, his master. And what do you suppose would happen when Hagar went back to Sarah? You suppose she got over her fit of anger and they reconciled in some way? That seemingly they did, didn't they? And of course, Ishmael, the son, was born. So, if we have a scene like this, and many of you, I'm sure, as parents, have had this scene, where there's an argument in the family and somebody runs away. You had your kids, our daughter when she was little, got angry and didn't want to do something. I don't remember the details, but she packed some crackers in a sack and took her teddy bear and she ran away. And her brother came back and reported, was she sitting on the curb down at the end of the block? And when he asked her, why are you here? He said, I'm not allowed to cross the street. So it happens. And the advice is, get over it, go back, take the responsibility that's yours, and mend the fence, and go back and do what you're supposed to do. Now, when we encounter a situation like that, do we need an angel to come and tell us what to do? Or do you suppose we can understand that God's will in the matter, unless somebody is being sadly mistreated? I mean, you can imagine someone running away from a situation where they've been beat up, almost killed. Well, that's a different kind of situation. But in a situation like this, God's will in the matter is go home, go back, return. And so you can give that. And in this situation, you see, you become God's messenger. And realize that's all an angel is, isn't it? We talked about that all along. The messenger, that is the angel of God's will, comes and tells somebody what God wants them to do. And we'll see that again and again in this dozen cases. So this one's pretty simple, but it illustrates what I want you to look for. It may be that you could take the place of a major character in the scene, and rather than that of the angel. But that's all we want to do, and we're going to practice with these dozen cases. Let's look at the next one. Now, you know the story here. After Abraham had entertained these three angels, two of them went down to Sodom to rescue Lot and his family. And God's intention was to destroy the city because of its wickedness. And so these two angels went into the city, and Lot entertained the strangers in this situation. He did what his uncle Abram had done. And so he took them home with him, and there were a lot of twists and turns to the plot. But with the coming of dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away when the city's punished." What's about to happen to Sodom? It's going to be destroyed. And so they have to get out of the city. Now, why is Lot in this predicament? When they divided their herds, he and his uncle, Abram, he took the lush lands of the Jordan River, and he wound up in the city of Sodom. He made a series of bad choices, and we don't know the details of them all, but you wouldn't recommend that anybody live in Sodom when you see what Sodom was like. And why he lived there, we don't really know. Maybe his daughters led him to do that, or his wife, or someone else recommended it, and he went. But it was a bad choice. And do we ever wind up in a predicament sometimes because we made bad choices? Has that ever happened to you? And you wonder, what should I do now? Well, what was God's will in this matter? Get out. Leave this situation. Escape. Get out while the getting's good. And so the angels told him that and led him out of the city. And, of course, the city was then destroyed. And there's much more to the story, but these are the basic elements of the story. Hurry. Leave this place. And what does the New Testament suggest when we get into a situation like that where there's lust and wickedness and stuff around us? What does Paul and the other writers say to do? Flee wickedness. Yeah, we get that recommendation in a number of occasions. Get out of that situation. And you can tell a friend who's in that situation. What you need to do is to change your environment completely. And that's hard. That's hard advice to take. If you've ever been there and someone has advised you, maybe a parent, this isn't a good relationship you're developing. This isn't a good situation that you find yourself in. Flee this situation. And that's what was God's advice, and that, in a nutshell, is what the angels told Lot. And, of course, they're only going to say what God told them to say. We understand that. As messengers, they're not going to change the message. But we live in a time and a place where we get into these predicaments which are much like this one, and we should, we already know what God's will in the matter is, and we can take the place of the angels and advise someone else to get out while they can get out, because they're sinking into worse and worse situation. And that's something that we have to be aware of, and it's a hard piece of advice to give, and it's even harder to take. Okay, the third one here. And this has to do with Ishmael. You remember he was born. He was about 10 or 12 years old. And when Sarah gave birth to Isaac, there was a problem here in that Ishmael was somehow making fun of Isaac or something. And Sarah had all she could stand. And so she complained to Abraham to get rid of Hagar and Ishmael. And the matter distressed Abraham greatly because it concerned his son. But God said to him, "Do not be so distressed about the boy and your maidservant. Listen to whatever Sarah tells you, because it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. I will make the son of the maidservant into a nation also, because he is your offspring." That's kind of an interesting statement in its own right. Early the next morning, Abraham took some food and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar. He set them on her shoulders and then sent her off with the boy. And she went on her way and wandered in the desert of Beersheba. When the water in the skin was gone, she put the boy under one of the bushes. Then she went off and sat down nearby, about a bow shot away, for she thought, "I can't watch this boy die." And as she sat there nearby, she began to sob. And evidently the boy was crying too. God heard the boy crying, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What's the matter, Hagar? Do not be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies there. Lift the boy up and take him by the hand, for I will make him into a great nation." Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. So she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. And they were revived, and they went on. You know the rest of the story. And she made a successful separation from Abraham and his family. What's the picture here in general? We have a scene of somebody who's been thrust into a circumstance, and they get what? Depressed and sad, don't know what to do, lost. And what did Hagar do? She just gave up, didn't she? And she was innocent too in the matter. That's right. Well, we think she was. We aren't given all the information about the story. But here she was. And what was God's will in the matter? That she should just give up and she and Ishmael should die? He had other plans for Ishmael. Ishmael was going to become a nation as well, and that wasn't God's will. You ever encounter anybody who's depressed because of the circumstances of their life and they've been left sort of stranded somehow? That's the picture that we have here. And what does God want them to do? Well, don't give up. You have resources around you that you can't see at the moment. But when Hagar's eyes were open, she found a well of water, which was just what she needed. The well was there all along. She just hadn't seen it. And so things fell into place, and she was able to go on, and her son grew up and became a man. So there is a way out if you don't give up. And I think that's the message. And all of the circumstances we find in life aren't that simple. I realize that. But I'm just saying, in general, when you get stuck in a situation like that, you might be like Hagar. or you may know someone who's like that and you are going to be the angel in the matter, then you should go to them with God's message, which is, don't give up. You have resources and opportunities that you haven't explored. Now here's a different kind of circumstance. Here's some people in trouble. The whole nation of Israel was in trouble. And they had been invaded by the Midianites and overcome. And for some long period of time, the Midianites had come every year and taken away all their crops and their cattle. And they were really having a hard time. You talk about economic depression. They were in the midst of it here. The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash, the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. You don't normally thresh wheat in a wine press. It's not big enough. But it's the best he could do, and he could sort of hide in there and hide his he probably didn't have very much wheat anyway, but what wheat he had, he could sort of hide and keep it from the Midianites. And when the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." That was the least of any message that Gideon was expecting to receive, wasn't it? He's just somebody's son, and he's trying to struggle to get enough wheat to make a loaf of bread, and here comes an angel to tell him this. But sir, and what do you suppose, does Gideon know it's an angel? His initial response here suggests he thinks it's just a man. "But sir," Gideon replied, "if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all the wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hand of Midian." Then the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?" And the rest of the story, Gideon begins to realize this is an unusual visitor that he has, and he discusses this question about leading Israel out of their trouble with him, and this is the occasion where, you remember about the fleece? He puts the fleece out, and it dews all around the fleece, and the fleece is dry, or the fleece is wet, and the ground all around is dry. He's looking for signs to reinforce his faith a little bit, that this really is God's will, that he should be their leader. Well, do you ever face a situation like that in life, or people do, I'm sure, where you're asked to be a leader? You're asked to take the lead in some situation, and you don't feel strong enough or wise enough or active enough or knowledgeable enough to know what to do. And God comes and gives you an opportunity to help the circumstances in which your family or your neighbors or your city or your state, maybe the whole country, is involved in, and you have been given an opportunity to do something about it. And most of us shrink from such an opportunity, don't we? We don't want to get involved. We live sort of a life in the background, and we like it that way. But God's will may be for you to take an active leadership role, and he comes, and the angel comes and tells you this. You may recognize somebody in your life who has the qualities of leadership. Can you encourage them like the angel did, knowing that it's God's will that we step out and do what God wants us to do, particularly as it has to do with the congregation of the Lord's people? And so don't shrink back from the opportunities that you have. The angel said, what about his strength? Go in the strength that you have. I'm not strong enough, wise enough, active enough, healthy enough, but you've been given some strength. And go ahead and use that in the Lord's work. And you become an angel encouraging somebody else to do the things they need to do. You may not be the Gideon, but you can be the angel, because you know what the Lord's will in the matter is, that we all take the opportunities that we have in serving God and use them to the best of our ability. Elijah was afraid, ran for his life. Why was he running for his life? This is 1 Kings 19. Well, who was going to kill him? We talked about this one before when we talked about angels and prophets. Jezebel was after him. She was going to kill him. Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there while he himself went a day's journey into the desert. He came to a broom tree, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. "I've had enough, Lord," he said. "Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under the tree and fell asleep. All at once an angel touched him and said, "Get up and eat." He looked around, and there by his head was a cake of bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate and drank and then lay down again. The angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, "Get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you." So he got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights till he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. And there he went into a cave, spent the night. The angel came and fed him. The angel had some sort of miraculous food here that sustained Elijah for 40 days on a journey where he wasn't eating and drinking on the days he traveled, but the food he had was enough to sustain him for over a month. Now, that'd be marvelous food, would you just eat once a month? Although I don't know if any of us could stand it, eating only once a month. We'd overdo it, wouldn't we? But you could be the one who provides what someone needs when they're seriously depressed, like Elijah was. Elijah was kind of like Hagar, wasn't he? "I've reached the end of my rope. There's no point in going further. I'm ready to die. I've done all I can do." And later on in the story, he lists all of the things that Israel has done and hasn't done. And they've torn down your altars and they're worshiping idols. And I'm the only one left. That was his feeling in the matter. But the angel told him, "Eat, drink. The journey's too great for you. And when you supply just some food and water for somebody who's depressed, that can make a difference, can't it?" In the sermon this morning, Jesus in the 25th chapter of Matthew said, what? "When I was hungry, you fed me." And so we need to be aware of the opportunities that we have to make a difference in someone else's life by simply providing them with food and encouraging them to go on. Don't give up. It's not the end of the line. And as the story ends, God gives Elijah a list of things that he wants him to do yet. God has other things in mind for him. And so somebody that you know that is depressed, and you may look at them and say, "Well, they're old and weak and sick, and I can feed them, but they're not going to be able to do anything." Well, you don't know whether they can or not. God can give them strength if you will encourage them and provide them with some nourishment. That word edify means feed, doesn't it? Yeah. Feed them scripture, but also feed them food. The reasons we come to worship is to edify one another. That's right. A couple of them about Daniel. And the first one's one we teach our children. Daniel's enemies got him in a situation where the king was forced to put him in the lion's den. Through deceit and conniving, they got the king to issue an edict that he wished later on he hadn't made. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. What was Daniel doing? He was worshiping God, wasn't he? That was the only reason why they trapped him, because the edict says you can only worship the king. And so the king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. So here we have a man who's righteous, upright, and a great leader in Israel, even though they're in Babylonian captivity and later on Persian captivity. He's made his way through the ladder of success in the government, and he's a great leader in the kingdom. So a stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the cave, the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles so that Daniel's situation may not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating, without any entertainment being brought to him, and he couldn't sleep. His conscience, of course, hurt him, and he was sorry for the problem that he had given his friend Daniel. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. And when he came to the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? And Daniel answered, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They've not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you, O king. And the king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. When Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he trusted in his God. So here's an angel. We know that when we get into situations sometimes where we don't have any control, and we are there not because of any fault of our own, God's concern. Sent an angel. And the angel did what? He didn't kill the lions. He just shut their mouth. So they weren't hungry, I guess. And they didn't mind spending the night with Daniel. And they didn't attack him or anything. You know, we sometimes get in situations in our life where we fear things that might happen. And this was an obvious danger. And sometimes we have dangers in our life too where we worry so much about it that it makes us sick, really. But God's will in the matter is to preserve us. He has things he wants us to do. He's not going to let these things happen. And sometimes our worries are our own worst enemy. Now in this situation, you don't have the power that the angel had to shut the mouth of the lion. But you can encourage people by telling them things aren't quite as bad as you imagine them to be, and God will help you out of this situation. Be a messenger of that sort in these circumstances. Now Gabriel came to instruct Daniel. Daniel had been praying and confessing the sin of the people of Israel and making a request to the Lord his God for his holy hill, that is Jerusalem. While I was still in prayer, he says, Gabriel, the man I had seen in the earlier vision, came to me in swift flight. That's the only verse we have in the Bible suggesting that angels have wings, but they don't need wings except in air. And we don't know, I don't think they need wings anyway, because remember the angel in the case of Gideon ascended in the smoke of the sacrificial fire. No, that was in the case of Samson's parents. But anyway, he came to him at the time of the evening sacrifice. But they're not making sacrifices, are they, in Babylon? They're prisoners. They're exiles. And there's no temple. But Daniel's still keeping track of those things. He instructed me and said to me, Daniel, I have now come to give you insight and understanding. As soon as you began to pray, an answer was given, which I have come to tell you, for you are highly esteemed. That tells us some things about Daniel that are really outstanding. To be esteemed by heaven should be our goal, shouldn't it? And his prayer was answered just as he began to pray. God knew what he was about to ask. And therefore, consider the message and understand the vision. So he's giving him some information about the future of Israel after they get back to Jerusalem. And that's another story. But what about the circumstances here? The angel was sent. God sent the angel in response to a prayer asking for wisdom and understanding. Do you ever pray that prayer? You ever ask God to help you be a little wiser in life and better able to understand the problems that you face and the people around you that you're trying to win to Christ, the circumstances in your family? Ask for wisdom like Daniel did here, and God will certainly answer that, and we can encourage other people to do the same. If you ask believing, and there's a verse of scripture about where the wisdom comes from, isn't it, in James? An interesting one here, number 8, was mentioned in the morning sermon about the rich man and Lazarus, a rich man who had everything in this life that you could ask for, and a beggar at his gate who didn't have anything and would have eaten out of the garbage of the rich man's kitchen, of course. Time came when the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. And the rich man also died and was buried. Can you imagine the rich man's funeral? I think that's kind of an interesting contrast, isn't it? The rich man must have had an elaborate funeral. And all of his family and friends and everybody who had hoped to profit from his death, I suppose, and his inheritance, had an elaborate funeral for the rich man. They all always did that and probably was buried in a large tomb. What about the beggar? Whose death would you have preferred? Well, when you go on with the story, it's pretty obvious. The beggar had the better deal, didn't he? He didn't have much in this life, but the angels carried him to heaven, to Abraham's side. You read about these stories that people tell. I'm going to give you a conjecture here. I don't know that this is the case. But those who have died and then been revived again by perhaps medical means, and they tell stories about having traveled through a tunnel toward a light. You remember those stories, and you wonder, what does all that mean? I don't see angels in any of those stories. It leads me to believe that although they've been given a second chance and have been returned to the living, they had not obeyed God. And some of them perhaps will, given a second chance. But Jesus, in this same story, talked about the fact that it wouldn't do any good if God sent Lazarus back to the rich man's brothers. They wouldn't believe it, even if someone rose from the dead, which, of course, is prophetic about the future in Jesus' life. A couple of them, we're running short of time here. A couple of them, numbers 9 and 11, we'll look at together. We talked about both of these on Wednesday night. I don't know that you need to read all of the details, but the high priest and the members of the Sadducees put the apostles in jail for teaching about Jesus. But during the night, an angel of the Lord opened the doors of the jail and brought them out. Go stand in the temple courts and tell the people the full message of this new life. And so that's what they did. Now, in the case of Peter, his life was threatened because Herod had just killed James, and he got a good response from the Jews, so he was ready to kill Peter. He was in prison, and you read the details. He was bound between two soldiers with two chains and in a dark prison at night, and an angel came and rescued him. It was kind of interesting. The church was earnestly praying to God for him, and when he shows up at the door of the house where they're praying, and when this is over, it's almost humorous, isn't it? They can't believe it's Peter. It's like the congregation praying for rain and nobody brought an umbrella. So you have to wonder about the faith of these people. But Obviously, that's not a critical part of the story. But we don't recommend that you go set people free from jail, not in our society anyway. People who are in jail have recourse to legal proceedings, which the people in Jesus' time didn't have, of course. And these two individuals, well, the apostles, and in this case Peter, were in jail unjustly, and God got them out of jail. But what can we do? Do you know some people in prison? Actually, you do. We all do. And you may say, well, I don't know anybody in jail. Well, if you've ever worked in a hospital, you know people who've fallen ill, and they're in a hospital, and they can't get out. It's not that that it's impossible to get them out, but they're there, and they really feel imprisoned, especially at MD Anderson Hospital, where I worked for a long time. Get cancer, and you're in there, and you're afraid to go anywhere because the doctors are working to cure you. And so they're really sort of trapped in a situation that's really kind of bad. And it's not just cancer, heart disease, and a lot of other things, too. People are in the hospital a long time. And I was sick and in prison, and you visited me, Jesus said. That's important, isn't it? And we need to do that. We need to go visit these people, because when you visit someone in the hospital who's sick, that period of time sets them free of their problems. They're visiting with you, and you can give them some freedom from their worries when you're there with them. So you can take the place of an angel in this situation and kind of open up their life a little bit, provide them with the things that they need, and encourage them in getting well. Paul saved in a shipwreck. And we got one more beside this one, but we'll get back to it in a minute. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and the storm continued raging, we all finally gave up hope of being saved. Paul was on his way to Rome to be tried before Caesar, and he had advised them not to take this trip from Crete because it was winter coming on and the season wasn't favorable for ships, but they went anyway. And they shouldn't have, and they got caught in, I guess, something like Hurricane Ike here from the description of it. After the men had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. We love to say, you should have listened to me, right? But anyway, that's not the point of the lesson. Okay. Then you would have spared yourself this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of the God whose I am and whom I serve stood beside me and said, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar. And God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island. And the ship was lost, but all of the people on board were saved. What circumstance in life do you suppose this represents? What do you think? Have you ever told somebody, your life's in danger, but the God whom I serve is going to rescue me, and he will rescue you too? Does that suggest anything? I think this is sort of symbolic of the church, isn't it? God will rescue us from this world, no doubt about it. The angel doesn't have to stand beside you to tell you that that's the case. And so you need to be encouraging those around you that they can be saved too. I think that's the point. You take the part of the angel in this situation, because you know God's will for the people all around you. He's not willing that any should be, what, lost, but all should be saved. So we're in a ship together. The ship's going to sink. This world isn't going to last. And people are going to die. But you have God's will, and you can explain it to those around you. And the last one we're going to look at is Cornelius, number 10 on your list. Cornelius lived in Caesarea. a centurion, and we talked about this at Wednesday night, he and all his family were devout and God-fearing, and he gave generously to those in need and prayed to God regularly. Isn't that a pretty neat person? He's really very nice. And you know some nice people like Cornelius. All of you do. People who kind of believe in God. They worship him imperfectly. But they're God-fearing, and they're nice to those around them, give to those in need, and they say their prayers. One day at about 3 p.m, he had a vision. He distinctly saw an angel of God who came to him and said, "Cornelius," and he stared at him in fear. "What is it, Lord?" he asked. The angel answered, "Your prayers and gifts to the poor have come up as a remembrance before God. Now send men to Joppa to bring back a man named Simon, who is called Peter, staying with Simon the tanner, whose house is by the sea." And you know the rest of the story. Peter was there. He had to be sort of urged to go with the crew that came to bring him back to Cornelius. But what role can you play in a story like this? You can be the one who puts Cornelius into contact with the person who has the plan of salvation. Or you can be Peter and teach the person what God wants him to do, can't you? We have the power in this day and age to do what the angels did. You see, before all of this was clear to mankind, God sent angels. But now he sends men and women. I don't mean to be distinguishing there. He sends human beings to take the place of the angels to do the things that angels used to do. And so someone in your life may show up to help you in a situation like we've talked about here, and they're really an angel in a human disguise. But most of the time, it's just humans. Do we see angels today? Well, remember, angels are simply messengers. Messengers from God. And we have the story. We have the information. God's given us all of the scripture. It's all there. And you can read it and understand it yourself, and then you can be an angel to somebody else. And that's really what God has intended all along. He's not going to send someone to Cornelius to tell him what to do to be saved. All he had to do was to put him in contact with men who knew what to do to be saved. And so that happened. And so we need to be willing to take that place in all of the circumstances of life. Angels, ministering spirits sent to serve those who inherit salvation. And you're a ministering spirit. Do you know that? And you're actually a little, right now you're a little below angels in your powers, but ultimately you'll be above angels. But you have the powers of knowledge and wisdom of what God wants you to be in this world among people who are lost, and you can provide them with the information that they need. Thank you for this class. It's been a good one for me. I've learned a whole lot. I hope you've learned a little bit of something too. And we'll begin a new class next week, and I hope you'll be back.